Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and happy new year, my friends. I'm Eric Olson. It is time once again for America's Most Haunted. We are very excited to be back after a brief holiday break, and I could not be much more excited about talking to two world-famous, accomplished, cool guy authors who have once again paired up for book two in the Order of the Sanguines series. And I'll tell you what, that first one grabbed me by parts that I will not divulge over the radio and held me all the way through. I am digging into the second one. It's okay with me to not have finished. I typically don't finish books when I'm speaking with the authors because I don't want to give away too much. But I'll tell you what, this is really something. Those of you who know me, I don't read all that much fiction, and it's not for any particular reason other than I just don't have that much time. I have to read nonfiction. As you guys know, we've been working really super hard, crazy mad, on the America's Most Haunted book, which I am extremely excited. And I wish Teresa was here. Hopefully she'll check in here soon. The book has been officially received and accepted by Berkeley Penguin. So we are really excited about that. And I enjoy talking, actually, about the author process. Hopefully it's not too boring to you guys out there. But I am sure that James Rollins and Rebecca Cantrell can tell you, will agree with me, that when a book is edited and you don't see a mark for 10 or 15 pages at a time, that is a huge relief. That was amazing. So we're very excited. So pretty much the book's been accepted as is, a couple tweaks here and there. We had a couple of chapters had slightly different structure from the other ones. We're just going to tweak those. We're putting in, instead of doing an index with the descriptions of some of the basic paranormal ghost hunting terms and then basic descriptions of the equipment, instead of doing that in index form, we're going to do it in sidebar. And that's it, man. We are done. Too bad we have to wait until September for the thing to come out. Anyway, back to matters at hand. I was pretending that I was bantering with Teresa, as I typically do at the beginning of the show. But she has not arrived, so let us get to the matter at hand. The Order of the Sanguines is this series, and the authors are James Rollins and Rebecca Cantrell. And again, the first one was called The Blood Gospel. Amazing stuff. Who would have thought you can draw together, and I'm not going to get into it yet, the elements present and have them somehow, some way, all work? And man, it is exciting. It is action-packed. I think I read the whole last half the book in one setting. I was absolutely enthralled, and now the new one, the second one, is here, and it is Innocent Blood, the second Order of the Sanguines series. Welcome, James Rollins and Rebecca Cantrell.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rollins, and congratulations on your book. What's your book called?
America's Most Haunted, and it is exactly that. We selected the 10 most haunted, quote-unquote, obviously somewhat subjective, but the 10 most haunted public or semi-public locations in the United States. And we figured we better go that route because what difference does it make if people can't go and visit the place, you know? So these are all
great
places you can get into, you know, their former institutions, their hotels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we picked 10. They're mostly well-known, but we wanted to keep some wild cards. So I would say probably 7 of the 10 are fairly predictable, would be in most ghost hunters' top 10 or 20 or so. But we did come up with some slightly different ones, a little bit of a nod to geographic things. As I was talking to Rebecca right before we went on, she is, in fact, from Alliance, Ohio, which is not far from here. So we did a little bit heavy. We gave a nod to one or two that are in this general area. in the Northeast Ohio or Western Pennsylvania area that we may not have been aware of or almost certainly wouldn't have been aware of otherwise. And I think that's fine because we really do kind of want to cover the whole spectrum from the lesser known to the super haunts. And then what we're trying to do differently, and thus far, at least what we've heard from the editor, the book editor, is we've succeeded, is we wanted to go into a fair amount of depth, but not too much. Some of the books, pretty much all these places have a book written just about them, and some have more than one. And we didn't want to get into quite that granular a level. We wanted to really kind of get to the real meat of it and tell the stories of the hauntings associated with these places and try to do some original research and really get into the historical background and see if we come up with some original sources and whatnot. And we actually did, we were able to come up with several, we were either able to confirm or dispel several of these tales just in terms of their historical truth. So it was really fun, and we visited most but not all. It was just kind of a matter of time and getting things done, and, always, of course, money is always a factor. But we did get to most of them, and it was very interesting, really fun. Teresa is more the expert. She has been an actual paranormal investigator, ghost hunter for many years. I'm kind of came into it from the media door, but now I'm really into it, very interested. You can imagine how much I've learned, and it's fascinating from a philosophical standpoint, from a religious standpoint, metaphysical standpoint. I'm pretty much to the point after working on this now for a few years, worked on the book for, I guess, about the last year and a half, but was doing other things related to it prior to that. And I've kind of gone from, maybe 40% belief in the paranormal, that there is something going on, that we're, outside of our realm, whatever terminology, whatever you want to call it, whether it's just something is sort of prosaic, I guess, as just forms of energy that we don't understand yet or comprehend or know how to measure yet, to all the way, taking it all the way, I suppose, to the religious philosophical side of it, some whatever we want to call it. But now, having done the research, unlike some of these other areas of the paranormal, especially the cryptozoological side of things, where I've actually become less convinced that some of these things exist, and I've actually become less convinced about UFOs. But regarding ghosts, in the broadest sense of the word, I'm actually quite convinced now that there is something out there. There's just too much information, too much data, too many people, too many smart, reliable people have gone through these things. And again, I don't know exactly what it is, but I think there is something. So that was way more than you asked for. But that's my answer. So let's talk about you guys. How has that first book done? I thought it was fantastic. I mean, I just really loved it. It seems to have been quite well received. I believe that that's true. Is it?
It was. It was well received both critically, and it did happen to hit the top 10 on the New York Times list. So that was very exciting. With the new release, we're hoping for a similar track. So it's been an exciting time with this series.
All right, so now, to be honest, I am into the second one, but not very far. But that first one, like I said, that whole last tab was after I talked to you guys. Man, I just burned through it. I love the characters. Please tell, for those who are unaware, let's give the names of the books, of course, in the series. But tell us about the main characters and sort of the basic gist of it. And I know we still probably don't want to give away too much about the first book, let alone the second, but, let's let people know what they're getting into with this.
Well, the first book is called The Blood Gospel, and it begins with an earthquake in Masada, Israel, that kills hundreds of people and reveals a tomb buried in the heart of the mountain. And there's a trio of investigators, basically the heroes of our story. One is a military forensic expert. Another is a mysterious Vatican priest. And the third, and probably the prime character of the series, is a female archaeologist, Dr. Erin Granger. Now, she's a little bit disillusioned. She's had a tough upbringing. She's basically, her goal of life as a professional is to search for the biblical history, the history behind the Bible that's true, and to strip away anything that's sort of spiritual from it. You know, she believes the Bible might be a historical document that's been overlaid with a bunch of mysticism, and her goal as an archaeologist is to strip that away. Now, she's called forth with these other two to investigate this tomb buried at the heart of the mountain, and they make a macabre discovery of a crucified body of a mummified girl on the wall of that tomb. And they're quickly attacked. That sets the trio on the run, and they're thrust into a sort of a big race to recover what was once preserved in that tomb sarcophagus, which is a book rumored to have been written in Christ's own hand, possibly even in his own blood. And that thrusts Erin and the military forensic expert Jordan Stone and the Vatican priest Father Bruno Corza on this big epic adventure.
And boy, oh boy, is it. As I was saying to Rebecca right before we went on, that whole last portion of the book where they're under Rome, that is some exciting stuff from one thing to another, from like a freaking, what was it, vampire bear to various very well-known historical figures, are we allowed to say?
Sure. Sure.
You know, Rasputin, my God, you know, wow, you guys just, there have been so many stories that have used Rasputin, but I found yours really believable and compelling. It made sense, you know, as far as explaining his abilities and his role in history and where he is now. And the thing that you guys do really well is you really keep the reader really on the knife's edge between feeling like they have a sense of where things are going and then just kicking them right in the nads. I love that.
Well, you know,
repeatedly,
that's our goal.
Kicked in the nads.
Well, I mean,
by a pair of authors who are halfway around the world from each other. I love that. We should let people know that Rebecca is actually in Berlin, though she's American, and having ended up in Berlin from Hawaii, I think that really is pretty much opposite ends of the earth and climate and whatnot. And of course, you are both authors of, you know, very well known successful authors in your own right. I suppose before we go on and talk about this series and the new book, why don't we make sure that people know what you guys have done and continue to do on your own?
Rebecca, why don't you go first?
Okay. Well, the series that I wrote before I started the Order of the Sanguines was the Hannah Fogel Mystery Series, and that was a series of novels that were set in Berlin in the 1930s, and the main character was named Hannah Fogel, and she is a crime reporter in Berlin in the run-up to the Nazis taking power in Germany. The first one in that one is called The Trace of Smoke. And then in addition to that, I have a new series, and the main character in that is called Joe Tesla. And he is a software millionaire who gets agoraphobia and can't go outside anymore while he's in New York City, and he ends up moving into the tunnels underneath Grand Central Station. And the first one in that series is called The World Beneath.
Interesting. And you, James?
And, you know, I've known Rebecca since the beginning of her career. You know, she already had written her first book in the Hannah Fogel series and was taking one of my classes at one point as this week-long retreat. And I actually leaned on her more than almost anybody else because she was so skilled. And I've always loved her writing, and they've won awards. She always sort of hides her flame a little bit. She's won multiple awards for her books. She's just fantastic. What always struck me about her writing is her ability, with just a few deft strokes of the pen, to create these great pieces of history, very atmospheric, these great characters. But you know, other authors can do that, but sometimes it will take pages and pages to accomplish that, and she can just do it with a few deft strokes of her pen. And you know, when I was I got this idea for this concept, you know, I thought, you know, she's perfectly the point I want to write this. You know, she's got some to bring great things to the series. Because, you know, my background is more action-adventure. My main series is the Sigma series, from Map of Bones through last summer's book, Eye of God, that deals with a sort of a team of former Special Forces soldiers that have been retrained by in various scientific disciplines by DARPA, the Research and Development Wing of the military. And they're sent basically as field agents to against various technological and scientific and historical threats. And basically they're scientists with guns is my team. So, you know, I can bring the action and some weird creatures and weird science and weird history, but, you know, I knew this story needed something more depth, needed that atmosphere, the gothic quality to the story needed. And so I end up calling Rebecca. I don't know if Rebecca wants to share that conversation we had once upon a time. That seems like ages ago.
Sure.
Yes,
well, Jim called... Okay, thanks. Yeah, Jim called me out of the blue. And this is kind of probably a lesson in how not to interview somebody for a job. Because he called me up, and I was driving. So I pulled over to the side of the road and in the Target parking lot, actually, and asked him, you know, he said, I have this project, and I'd love for you to work on it, and it's going to be really great, and it's a lot of fun. And I said, well, it sounds terrific. What's it about? And then there's just dead silence. And he goes, I can't tell you. It's confidential. And so I'm sitting there going, okay, so this is like probably a year of my life, and I've got to trick him into revealing at least something so I know whether it's something I want to do. So I said, how about if I ask you yes or no questions, and then you can say yes or no or pass. And then there's this long pause, and Jim goes, fine. And then he just told me every single thing about the book.
I would not survive torture. I would not survive torture at all. I would blab immediately.
But once he did, I was so excited because it was such a fascinating world and there were so many cool things you could do with, you know, priests who were inside the Catholic Church who are living on transubstantiated wine who've been around for 1,000 years. There was just so much rich history and world building, and I could just see how many fascinating things we could do there. So I signed right up. So it's a good thing you caved under torture, Jim.
It's funny that you should mention, Eric, about the second half of the first book mostly being taking place underground in tombs and whatnot. When we began the second book, Innocent Blood, Rebecca says, Jim, we spent most of that first book underground. Can we get our characters a little breath of fresh air? Can we not go underground in the second book? I'm tired of being underground. Let's stay above ground for the second book, which she mostly did. Most of the book it takes place above ground. Of course, then, unbeknownst to me at the time, is she's working on the first book in her new series, the Joe Tesla series, The World Below, which the main character spends almost the entire time in the subterranean world below New York City.
He is not letting me live that down.
I'm not.
Ever.
I'm not letting her escape from that.
What is it? That brings up a really interesting point. I remember, as you know, as far back as the Kolchak. Remember the Kolchak, the Night Stalker series? Me too, with Darren McGavin, of course. And it started as, I think it was two TV movies, and then they were so successful and popular that they actually turned it into a series. I think it was only maybe a couple seasons, but we just a year or two ago, we got it on the whole series and the movies, TV movies, on DVD and went through them all. And my kids, who were at the time maybe, I don't know, you know, 10 or 11 and 5 or 6, I mean, they just loved them. Anyway, back, as usual, I'm digressing. My point was I was so fascinated with the underground element of it. And I think the first one, I think it was Seattle and the Seattle Underground, which is real. And, of course, many, or if even, I don't know, possibly most, certainly I know European cities do have undergrounds, whether they're tombs or just the old sewers or whatever the case may be, or just layer after layer, century after century, building on top. What do you think it is that seems to be really fundamental, deep fascination that we have with action, adventure, exploration taking place underground, and not just underground in general, but under cities or under urban areas? Why do you think that is? What is it about that?
Well, from a practical standpoint, from my standpoint as an author, you know, I'm writing these stories that always have a historical mystery attached to them or a bit of science that makes me go, what if? So I always have to find places to hide things. You know, now everything's Google mapped and scanned, so it's hard for me to say, you know, this lost artifact is you know, hidden somewhere. I usually have to then bury it underground somewhere just so that I can make sense that it's not seen. But in Rebecca's case, I mean, she has a fascinating reason why she set the Joe Tesla series specifically under New York, and I'll let Rebecca explain that.
I do? Okay. I'll make one up.
I was fascinated. Well, like the FDR story. Why don't you, I mean, to me that was fascinating.
Okay.
That's the whole reason I thought the book needed to be written was simply because of that.
Well, so New York has all these subway tunnels, and back when they first built it, there were a bunch of different transit companies building that were making tunnels between here and there. So there's about 100 miles of subway tunnels under there, and not all of them are used. But when I was doing the research of it, so you have all these elaborate subway tunnels that no trains go to anymore, and in particular, there's one stop where FDR would come from Washington, D.C. to New York, and there was a special place where his train would stop, and then there was an elevator where he could take his car up in the train directly to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. And it was during the war, and there were security reasons, and he also didn't want people to see that he was in a wheelchair. And the car that FDR used to ride back and forth in war times is still there underground in New York on a track, rusting. And if you're lucky, you can get a tour down to actually see it. And it's just standing there, and I guess it's too expensive to get it out now, and I think it's going to stay there forever. So it's kind of this bit of history that's just right there underground, and almost been, you know, it's kind of well hidden, and it was such an important part of American history in World War II.
Yeah,
that is amazing.
All of New York above ground there, that's just, you know, bustling and full of energy and, you know, millions of people and tourists. Yet, you know, you just go, you know, a few levels down, this whole mysterious world that not you know, most, you know, people that are on that subway or traveling by bus on the surface aren't aware of. And I just loved all the little fascinating details she put in that first book about what's really down below the surface of New York City.
And I think that goes back to the original question of why are people fascinated by what's underneath? And I think that's because we don't go there. We go through there or we walk over it, and there's this idea that there could be mysteries there that we don't even know about. And the idea of going under there is fascinating but also really scary. So I think people are much more comfortable doing that in fiction than wandering around the tunnels underneath New York City because, you know, who knows what you might find down there. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles live down there, for example.
My golly, you are right. That, yeah, that's it. And it's, you know, on the one hand, it's so close, physical proximity. It may just be literally feet away. And yet on the other, it's so far away. And I think elements of just that go back to the dawn of time in terms of tombs and burial and our feelings about that and about those and what they mean and what they represent, that's an element too. I just have this vivid picture in my mind from the Night Stalker, where he finds the vampire down in the underground under, I think it was the vampire, under Seattle, and everything's really well preserved, and it's in kind of like a house or the trappings of a home, you know, with furniture and furnishings and everything underground. And when I was a kid seeing that for the first time, I just found that absolutely fascinating. Back to your books now. How much of that Rome underground is real? How much was, I know you guys do lots of research, how much of your description is based on reality?
Most of it is actually real. We deal with a lot of things that are that there actually is a necropolis below St. Peter's Basilica. That's where they believe they found the bones to St. Peter's in this ancient basilica, the ancient necropolis below the city. Now, we, of course, expand a little bit beyond that. There's supposedly the ruins of the Circus of Nero sort of overlap The half of it's underneath the city of Rome, half of it's underneath the Vatican City property itself. And so once I sort of discovered that, I thought it'd be really fascinating if we have something take place in that Circus of Nero. And so we sort of overlapped a bit of our own imagination along with what's really down there.
Although those tunnels are real. I mean, the Circus of Nero, they did dig underground. They did keep animals there. They did bring them up to the surface in big, giant elevators into their arena and things like that.
That is amazing. And, of course, then that ties in at least tangentially with the amazing black hole that is the Vatican. Anything could be there, you know? I mean, it's, who knows? I mean, just, it's mystical, it's real, it's political. That's just an amazing environment.
What sort of was the genesis for this whole story idea was, you know, I saw a painting of the raising of Lazarus at LA Museum, and it's a very cryptic, very gothic sort of style painting done by Rembrandt. And it got me thinking, because the motif looks very vampiric, actually, if you look at the painting. Lazarus is rising from the grave, Jesus is above him. The onlookers look horrified at this event, rather than being happy about this miracle, they all look horrified. And so it got me thinking about vampirism and early Catholicism, and I began realizing how unusually or how well the trappings of the church, whether from hooded robes to crosses to celibate priests to the rite of turning wine into Christ's blood, how that sort of overlaps with the mythology of vampires. And so, you know, the church does have all these cloaks of ritual and mysticism and forbidden knowledge and secret places. You know, if vampires existed today, you know, they'd almost have to be, you know, kept in secret. Somebody would have to be protecting them. So if vampires exist today, I thought, you know, a good place for them to hide might be actually in the church. And so that began sort of this little seed that became this big story is enveloping the mysticism of Catholicism, the trappings of Catholicism with the mythology of vampirism.
Well, it really is an amazingly seamless combination. I mean, once you hear it, especially when you read it in the context of the book and the stories, then, I mean, it's one of those forehead moments. Why didn't I think of that? It's because, like you say, they just dovetail so neatly together. And that's, for me, kind of that basic foundation that you're talking about. I mean, for either just the book, the first book, or certainly for a series to work, I mean, either that basic premise connects with people or it doesn't. And the fact that it does so well, I think, is just it really was a stroke of brilliance. And then once you start imagining that world, you know, you guys do a remarkable job with the emotional side of it, because think of that conflict inherent in literally a priest, a genuine, legitimate, believing priest. This isn't, you know, some deranged pedophile or anything, but, you know, real priest who is also a vampire. And the part about the, you know, the water, or I should say the blood into wine, the communion aspect of it, that is genius. You know, it's just, what a brilliant cover for vampires, and a way to keep them alive without feeding on humans, which I'm guessing in pretty much any universe that has Christians would be a sin.
Right. Now,
yes,
when I looked at that first painting, I thought, if vampires existed during the time of Christ, how might have Christ dealt with those vampires? Would he have tried to save their souls? And if so, how would that look? And then, being raised Roman Catholic myself, I was very much knew all about transubstantiation, the belief that wine physically turns into blood of Christ. And I thought, well, vampires, you know, survive on blood? What if Christ made a pact with them and said, if you only drink my blood, if you only drink transubstantiated wine, which is actually my blood, and only drink that and swear, you know, fealty or swear an oath to the church that you're going to serve the church, then upon your death, your soul will be returned to you. So that pact was made, and then I thought, well, how if that pact was made in the past, how might the church look today? And so that was great fun to play with, is that whole mythology and what's going on, how are they hiding these vampiric priests, and how has that changed the church? It was a great deal of fun to play with.
And being raised Catholic, of course, it's no fun being a priest who's also a vampire. Jim made sure there was a lot of torturous elements to it.
Oh, my. There is hand-wringing galore in that character. What a great character. I see, and I certainly buy that Aaron is kind of the central figure, is the pivot point, perhaps, of the series. But certainly Rune is my favorite character. He's so strange and believable and interesting. And his backstory, I mean, I was there. I shed a tear, the poor guy.
Well, wait till the second book. That's
You learn much more about Rune's background and his primary sin or his primary wound that he's probably that he's dealing with throughout most of the series. And we're not done with him yet. The third book, we have some more surprises yet for Rune.
Are there just going to be three?
Not out of the woods yet. Yes, we're actually working on the third book right now. Matter of fact, during our book tour for this book, we at every one of our stops, we put a question to the audience. Why don't you share that, Rebecca? I'll let you.
Oh, sure. So we were trying to choose a title, and we had initially come across the title of Blood Eternal. And then while we were on tour, we came up with the idea of Blood Infernal. So we were asking every audience what they thought. And I'll ask you in a minute, Eric, which one you prefer. But what was interesting is it was not at all consistent. So, like, people in Arizona were absolutely Blood Infernal fans. And then people in Denver were strongly Blood Eternal fans. And it kind of went back and forth. And so at the end, we asked the question a lot, and we got no answer. So what do you think, Eric? What's a better title?
I'm thinking of creating some neologism contraction, create your own new word, blending eternal and infernal, since they're so close as it is. I don't imagine you could get away with that. If I have to, in the real world, if I had to pick, I'd probably go infernal just because it feels more dangerous.
Right. I agree.
Yeah, I think so, too. But
and people don't necessarily know exactly what infernal means. So you would benefit, I think, from a little bit of the ambiguity, whereas people know what eternal means.
Yeah, and it also, with vampires, it seems kind of obvious, too.
Right.
But it's still, I don't know, but I still like it, but I think Infernal is what we're going to end up going with.
Yeah,
right,
who knows? At this point, the editor may say, you know, we don't like either title. Take something new. You mentioned at the beginning of the program about how you only had marks like every 10 pages or so, and I've never experienced that, Eric. Mine are always marked up.
Oh, my
so
God. I had not either. I had not. That's why this was so, such a blessing, you know. But we also worked really, really hard. I mean, I was coming into this, you know, my last book was almost 15 years ago. So I've had this long period where I've basically been writing for the internet, whether for my own sites or for online publications. And so I've been working as an editor, you know, kind of all along now for quite a while myself, thinking like an editor and having to both edit myself and then edit others. At Blog Critics, I mean, when I sold Blog Critics in 2008, we had a couple thousand writers. So, I mean, you can imagine the range of skills and you know, readiness for publication. So, you know, I had to learn how to really, really edit and myself and others. So I think that experience, I really tried to be mature about this and act my age for a change, and really go over it and over it and over it and over it and over it. You know, just like, man, I'm going over it again. And you guys know how it is. And
oh, yeah.
Interesting, I wanted to tell you this. I'd made a note of this. When I was talking for the first time to all this happened, and I had never talked to our editor. I mean, like once, literally, hello, goodbye on the phone, but no conversation. So just yesterday, Monday, I talked to her for the first time. So we were kind of going over things, and I had some questions. Mostly I was just saying, thank you so much, thank you so much, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. But when we started getting into some details, she said, yeah, well, you know, and I got to tell you, I really appreciate your appreciation because I don't hear that very much, don't hear that very often. And she said, the way it tends to work is this. The fiction writers, they're the really, really good writers. And while we may have ideas in terms of structure, you know, rearranging this or that or tidying up this or that kind of thing, as far as the writing itself goes, you know, with the fiction writers, at least at that, you know, at the major publisher level, they're good, and the writing's really, really good. She said on the nonfiction end, who it tends to be, who are tending as a rule to work with, are people who are really experts in a given field, and they know that field really well. They're passionate about it. They're either literally, you know, movers and shakers within that field themselves, or they're observers of it, but they're not necessarily great writers. They're not necessarily polished professional writers. So, you know, we end up doing a lot of rewriting and a lot of editing on the nonfiction side of things. So that is a compliment to you guys that you, the fiction writers, have to be the really, really good writers. And I know just from our last conversation, I know you guys, you know, really go over things and you interact and communicate with each other very regularly and pass things back and forth and kind of polish up you know, each other's work, and every word really does count. So that's how I approached it. I mean, I just really tried to make it sing, and a lot of it is removing, you know, it's just taking out those extra words, and people who don't realize or haven't done a lot of editing, they just have no idea what an enormous difference it makes as far as readability and smoothness and flow. Just taking out, you know, 5 words on a page can make all the difference in the world. And so anyway, you know, to what you guys do, I mean, I am just absolutely in awe, because not only do you guys have to do and know how to do and figure out how to do what I'm good at, which is just kind of making things flow and be logical and have one paragraph, you know, follow from the next and have it be readable and hopefully compelling. Not only do you have to do that, but you have to imagine this entire world and create palpable, real feeling characters, and you guys are great at it.
Oh, well, that's fun to me.
Yeah, that's the fun part.
That's the fun part. The hard part is what you just described, which is finding that word that needs to be eliminated to make that paragraph stronger. I mean, your editor is lucky that she had you on hand, who has has some background in editing, has written a lot. So when it comes to writing a nonfiction book, you know, you have somebody that has that skill set that you have. I'm sure probably if not now, soon, she's going to come up with the question, so, Eric, you know, what are you working on next? Are you anticipating doing, like, European most haunted places?
Oh, I hope so. I do hope so. We have – part of what we've been doing over this year and a half, we created or launched the brand, the name, America's Most Haunted, a year ago in July, so in other words, a year and a half ago. And at that point, we started the Twitter, we started the Facebook, we started this radio show, and those were our outlets. We kind of determined, I can't really take credit for it because a lot of it was just circumstantial, but we did hold off on starting a site because I actually wanted to work on the social media side of it before, because I know how much is involved with a site, especially where you're publishing original content. I mean, that becomes very much full-time. So I kind of wanted to do everything else before we started the site. In fact, we'll be launching a site now, America's Most Haunted site, soon. You know, I've been saying soon for the last couple months, but now I think we are finally down to a week or two. So we've kind of reversed the process. But, you know, so in the course of that, we really wanted to get the word out. We wanted people to become familiar with the brand and think of it as an ongoing entity. And you can imagine how amazed we were to find out that nothing existed called America's Most Haunted. I mean, the simple fact that it was available was, oh my God, that's like a sign from heaven, you know, the fact that name, that brand is even available. There's never been a book. There's never been a TV show. It's not out there. So, I mean, we really lucked out on that because it's such a kind of fundamental sounding name. So,
right.
Yes, back to your question, I'm hoping, and that's part of, I suppose, why we just were so fanatical about trying to make sure that this first one, you know, really is good and do all we can to promote it and help sell it and beat those bushes and really, really, you know, help make it happen to the best of our ability when it is released and certainly prior to release. Because I would very much like for it to be a series. As I said, you know, the 10 that we picked, I think we can defend those 10 very easily, and I certainly, you know, don't apologize for it, but we could have easily picked a different 10, you know. So there's no limit. I mean, we could probably easily do 5, 6, 7, you know, America's Most Haunted books before we would even have to move on to other geographical areas, but, you know, kind of whatever they would want us to do. You know, I've finally arrived at this stage of my life, rather late on, you know, kind of where I was thinking I would be 30 years ago, and finally have a brand. I have something to pursue in terms of, you know, working hopefully at the quote-unquote highest level, working with a major publisher. I mean, we hope we get a TV show out of it. Teresa actually has a fair amount of specifically paranormal investigation TV experience behind her. She hasn't had her own show yet, but she's appeared on several other shows and done investigation and done very well, I think, you know, on camera. I have TV background, more just being kind of a critic or a opinionator, I suppose, doing things like that. You know, I was the music critic on the Fox Morning Show here in Cleveland back in the 90s, stuff like that. So, you know, we both have a fair amount of TV and media background, and if it makes sense, you know, it would be fantastic if this also, you know, turns into a TV show, kind of multimedia affair. So yeah, I hope so. And looking at what you guys do and the fact that it really does make sense, both I think probably from an economic standpoint, certainly, but then also, you know, creatively, the fact that you have, when you have a series to work with, then you can think in larger themes and overarching themes. And that has to be, I would think that's a really fun part of it.
I mean, I've always loved reading, you know, things that are, you know, the thicker the book, the more of a doorstopper it is, the happier I'm at. So I also think that it's fun to explore a concept or a world in as large a landscape as possible. So, you know, whether it's a, you know, series or whether it's a, you know, one book, you know, it's fun playing with that, those different worlds, trying to expand them as well as you can.
Hey, one thing we haven't really talked a whole lot about, and I've ended up blabbing even more than usual, and I am a blabber, there is no doubt about that. And I forgive me for that, please. But I do very much want to get back to the new book. We haven't really talked a whole lot about the plot and what's going on. You know, obviously you can only give away so much, but I'd love to hear a little bit more and let the people really get excited about the new one, which is Innocent Blood. Just came out about a month ago, and again, this is the second book in the order of the, ooh, I love the way Rebecca said it, Sanguines. It sounds so much cooler than when I said Sanguines.
Basically, the second book picks up where the first book leaves off. We structure each book so that it has sort of each book has a beginning, middle, and end, so that there's a sort of a satisfying conclusion to each book. And so Blood Book Gospel ends in a very satisfying note. But there's a little bit of a mystery left unsolved.
Oh, yes.
That's where we pick up with this book, is following the trail of a mythical creature called the First Angel. There's a prophecy that ends the first book, that unless the First Angel is discovered, that Armageddon may start. And so our trio is now in search for the First Angel, and that sends them in a global search. It also ties a little bit to the history and mythology surrounding Judas Iscariot, and some of the history involved with the lost years of Jesus Christ. You know, pretty much we know that Christ was born, the Holy Family fled with the Christ child after the slaughter of the innocents by King Herod. And then we don't really find out anything about Jesus Christ until he appears as a young teenager. So there's a whole gap in his chronology that's missing. And so we thought in the second book we wanted to sort of fill in that gap. We've talked to different researchers, different historians, got their viewpoint about where the Holy Family might have fled to. We took that information with our own imagination and sort of tried to fill in that gap. So it's a big, again, big epic story dealing with the early history of Christ, Judas Iscariot, and this mysterious first angel, which I can't tell you too much about because that's the crux of the story.
Right. Now, do you get in?
But I'd also like to talk about the little stuff. So we get to hear a lot more about Rune and Elizabeth Bathory, who's kind of mentioned in flashback in the first book, comes back in the second book, and we get to explore kind of the relationship between her and Rune and what the world's going to do now that she's unleashed. And so there's a lot of personal and emotional things that the characters are going through as a result of their past sins or their past actions in the previous book.
So many of our listeners, being the paranormal fiends that they are very familiar with her and who she was. Again, you're taking a real historical figure and weaving that person, into this. And the fact that this very sympathetic, for most of the telling in the first book, the backstory of that individual as to what she turned into. Oh, my goodness. Again, another blow to the nads. I loved it.
Yeah, she's, I think, was one of the funnest characters to write in the second book, was Elizabeth Bathory. I mean, she's probably even more conflicted and more fascinating than even Father Rune Corza in some respects.
Well, and she's evil. She kind of has no problem letting her inner evil out.
Which is always fun to write.
Yes.
Yes. Well, people. We have a lot of witches and historians of witchcraft and Wiccan and whatnot, or just the occult in general. And people are very familiar with who she is or was, and she was a real person, I guess. So that's another thing I admire about you guys. And those who are similarly successful, of which there aren't many, and that is the boldness with which, I mean, does it ever give you pause to take such aggressive liberties with real historical figures and to sort of bend them to your will? I love the manipulative aspect of it and the viciousness of it.
Well, for Elizabeth Bathory, I mean, we did try to find firsthand accounts of what she was like and what she had done and what the trial said about what her life had been like, so that we could use as much real historical information as possible to flesh her out as a character and to flesh her out as a person. But then once you've done all that and you've done all that homework and you've kind of done everything you can to embody that character, that, then I think you do have free range within that to have fun and to see what if. What if Elizabeth Bathory were alive today? What would she be like? How would she feel about what she had done? How would she react to an automobile? I mean, there are all these things that she's never seen. And what would that mean? So it's fun.
In historical context, I mean, she's a fascinating character in regards that there is that dichotomy in her personality, even from a historical standpoint. And a lot of the documents talk about how when she was at a younger age, she was a healer. She was taking care of a lot of people, and she was considered to be, you know, quite kind and caring. Yet we have to balance that with the monster that she's described as this person that's you know, flailing young women and killing peasants across the countryside. So, you know, how do you balance those two women?
I can't. I mean, and I'm a living, breathing dichotomy myself, but boy, I don't have anything close to that range.
Well, we have the answer.
Amazing stuff. Very, very excited about it. Hey, any information? To me, this series just seems, what an obvious visual. I mean, what a movie or a TV miniseries. Anything going on that front?
Not at this point. Most, when it comes to books like this, we don't really, or probably until we're done the third book and have sort of this first trilogy, even though we do anticipate possibly doing a second trilogy in this universe. You know, pretty much that. I think they need to see how the story ends before they probably will commit to anything on film. But, that, you know, I'd love to see it done on the big screen or the small screen for that matter.
Yeah, yeah. Or cable. You know, we get so many hybrids these days. You know, short.
The greatest stuff I think now is coming out of cable television. There's some, you know, some.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it fits so well. Just the characters, the sweep, the historical sweep of it, the action elements. I mean, you really do kind of have it all. And I found it. Let me see what term. Obviously, there's the overt religious elements. You know, you guys don't particularly take a stand one way or the other beyond describing this world. But I found it, maybe it's spiritual, I guess is what I'm looking for, as opposed to strictly religious. I found it spiritually very satisfying. I mean, it didn't feel to me like... like just, you know, junk food, like snack. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a fun story. It's well written. Lots of action. It's exciting. Hold your attention. It certainly does all that. But there is more to it. I found it really – I felt kind of full and fulfilled after the first one and what I'm into in the second. Seems to be certainly continuing on, you know, just as well. There is more to it. Is that something that you guys were aware of or you did on purpose? I mean, did it feel like there was something, there's another layer to it, there's some depth to it that may not always be there in a thriller, no matter how well written? Environment, or am I just reading too much into it?
No, I think we did a lot of work, particularly when we started and also throughout when we were plotting, to make sure there was a real deep mythology behind the story and behind how vampires of Strigoi are created and how they're integrated into the church, and so that the world would be as real and complex as we could make it and bring it across. And then I think once you work on characters and people, there's kind of interesting world with real people who have, or real singing people who have, you know, problems and things that they are facing and things that they are dealing with that the reader can understand and root for, then it gives it that kind of depth. So it's not just, you know, like a comic book. It's more like a deeper, and a lot of comic books and graphic novels do this as well, but it's a deeper world, a world where you can see the people and see the places, and because you've got that depth in there, I think it resonates a lot more with readers.
I think also with Erin, the main protagonist of the series, you know, she starts out sort of as a disillusioned you know, archaeologist. You know, she's sort of pulled between science and faith. Back when her early upbringing, she was sort of had a sort of brutal upbringing that she turned her back on any type of faith or religion or spirituality. She went very much to the other pendulum swing to basically science and logic. So, you know, here we have a character that's struggling with you know, the line between faith and science. So when you, I think when we humanize that, I think that brings another level of I think all of us try to, you know, are struggling between the known and the unknown. And when Aaron is experiencing that, I think it hopefully has some resonance with our readers also.
A good point. I think you're absolutely right. And all of that makes perfect sense. Well, sort of as I left you last time, I'm very excited to finish up this second book and see where things will be left and led on the third. I really love this universe that you have created. And there's so many interesting elements to it. And I mean, we haven't even mentioned there was at least the beginning of a love story in the first book.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
There's definitely a romantic element, and that is continuing in book number two. And there's some steps forward and steps backward, as all romantic relationships usually go. So there's more in store
it's
for them.
It's too
also.
Real. You guys are too real. You know, that's one of the values, I guess, of fiction is you are allowed to be real. I mean, you can be as real as the day is long with feelings and relationships and the way humans work, the way they interact, and it's strange and complicated. And sometimes it's hard to do that in or convey that in nonfiction. It seems like you can almost get deeper into the psyche or into the reality of the human world.
Well, that was taught as a
in fiction.
I was sort of teaching myself to write. So I had no formal training in writing. And one of the things I learned really early on was the definition between fiction and nonfiction. And I love this definition I heard from this one author. He says, you know, your goal as a nonfiction writer is to pass on information or pass on facts to your reader. Your goal as a fiction writer is to pass on emotions to your reader. And so, I mean, that's, I think, the critical difference between the two is what you were just describing is our goal as writers of fiction is to, you know, create an emotional world, an emotional experience for our readers, whereas nonfiction leans more towards passing on information to fascinate readers.
Good point. Excellent. Well, as I think I also said last time we spoke, I'm one step closer to being interested in trying my hand at fiction, because there are so many. Once you decide you're not afraid of the imagination side of it, which I've kind of always been, I don't want to get started on a big long story again here with 2 minutes left to go, but I actually wrote and was thinking in terms of story fiction when I was young, I mean like a teenager. And one time I wrote something that I felt so far drawn into my imagination that I was literally afraid that I couldn't get out of it. It was felt like a black hole to me. And I literally feared for my safety, at least of my psyche, I guess, in crawling back out of that. And I think that has really kind of swayed me in my thinking ever since. And I suppose it's just something I need to get beyond.
I think any author, that we are immersed in our stories. I mean, we live, breathe these characters. I think that's probably what you were experiencing, and possibly what frightened you a little bit was you become those characters. You become, you're drawn into that world, and I've, you know, been writing, and I've lost hours and hours of time that I really can't even sometimes place because I'm writing and I'm lost in that world. You know, what I suggest to you is, you know, come to the dark side, Eric.
Well, thank you. Thank you, James. All right. Well, so great talking to you guys once again. And boy, it couldn't have been a quicker hour. I really appreciate being able to talk to people who I admire so much and who have such specific skills that I can at least understand to a certain extent. You know, I mean, lots of people, I know you guys have thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of fans and people who love your work. But, you know, I feel I can at least understand what you guys have to go through and really admire it. And, yeah, I mean, I think I am getting closer. I can at least probably first step is just go back and do a few short stories. That's something that doesn't have to necessarily take, you know, forever or commitment of months or years, but that's probably my best step that way. Really appreciate.
I started writing short fiction. I wrote a bunch of short fiction to, you know, to start, and then I finally felt comfortable enough to tackle my first novel. So I think you know, short stories is a great place to dive in with fiction writing, is to, you know, fit that within the cracks of time of your own schedule and try different voices, different styles, and find out where your comfort zone is.
And have fun doing it. Don't make it all be tortured pain.
Oh, yeah.
I think writing should be fun.
Oh, I agree. For me, it's pretty hard. You know, I do go over things. I do really try hard to polish them and make them good and readable and come up with the best iteration of that idea, that concept, that phrasing, whatever the case may be. I do agonize to a certain extent, and that's probably something I could get away from a little bit more on the fiction side, because it is.
Oh, no,
we
all still agonize all the time.
Oh, I know.
I always joke, writing is easy, editing is hard.
Well, exactly, and that really is. You have summarized it. All right. Well, again, I really appreciate the time. Rebecca, you calling from Germany in the middle of the night, I really appreciate it. Such a pleasure to speak with the two of you, and I wish you only continued success. I'm very, very excited to finish this second book in the series and see what you come up with for the third. One more time, in fact, we haven't really referred. Please, each of you, let's make sure people know about your websites and your social media. The new book, of course, is Innocent Blood. It's the second book in the Order of the Sanguines series, and it is out on hardback right now. Been out about a month, and from what I'm hearing, it's doing quite well. So, yeah, let's let people know where they can find you and where they can get more deeply into your worlds.
Well, my website is jamesrollins.com, and I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, so you have a hard time avoiding me if you're on either of those at this point.
Yeah, I'm at RebeccaCantrell.com, and I'm also on Twitter and Facebook, so the various places.
Under those names. All right, well, thank you once again, and really appreciate the time and the insight. It's always fascinating, and hope things just keep continuing to go as well as possible for the two of you, separately and collectively.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for having us.
My pleasure. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Okay.
All right, my friends, another great show, America's Most Haunted. We missed Teresa, but it's okay. We're still kind of easing back into things after the holiday break. And actually pretty booked up. We got several shows in a row lined up, even though we're into the new year. Let me see. I'll give you a little quick hint on what we're doing next week. Ah, yes. We have my good friend, now good friend, Richard Kadrey, who another novelist who we were not able to interview on Christmas Eve, which, of course, fell on a Tuesday, so we had to try to do the show, because of technical problems with Blog Talk Radio. So we have rescheduled Richard, and we'll be talking about his new book, Dead Set, and it's his first young adult novel, and that will be next Tuesday, the 14th. Have a great week, everybody. We'll talk to you then, and be sure, of course, to check us out at AM Haunted on Twitter, and same thing, AM Haunted on Facebook. And coming very soon, we will have an America's Most Haunted website. Really looking forward to that. It's going to be all kinds of fun. Be a place to kind of put everything, a cornerstone for our burgeoning universe. So have a great week, everybody. Talk to you soon.